the state of Maine's insect population. It's been part of the conversation among naturalists and outdoors people in Maine for a few years now that there seem to be fewer insects than there used to be. Now the state has launched a survey to see if it's true, if what anecdotally seems to be happening can be measured. This effort to assess Maine's insect population follows a series of urgent reports about insects worldwide. One recent study in the journal Biological Conservation suggests that 40% of all insect species could die out in the coming decades. I'm Jennifer Rooks. On today's program, we'll learn which insects in Maine are threatened, and we'll get an update on some of the invasive insects entomologists are watching, including the brown-tailed moth and emerald ash borer. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Granted, bugs are often unwelcome, but recent news of a steep decline in the insect population is not something to be happy about. We will talk about what this means for our ecosystem, and we'll also learn about some of the invasive insects causing problems here in Maine. Joining me in the studio, Charlene Donahue. She is president of the Maine Entomological Society. I'm very proud that I pronounced that properly, and a retired Maine Forest Service entomologist. And Sarah Haggerty is a conservation biologist with Maine Audubon. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you noticed any changes in the insects that you see in your surroundings? Are you wondering what to do about some of the invasive insects causing harm here? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you both for being here today. Charlene, I think that a lot of people are shocked to see that report issued a few weeks ago saying that 40% of the insects worldwide are in decline and could die out in the coming decades. How did researchers assess this? What do you know about this study?
It's a difficult thing to get your arms wrapped around because insects are so complicated. There's so many millions of different kinds of them. And so it took some real digging to find some studies that could look at what had happened in the past and what is happening now.
And so this was in two different parts of the world, correct? Germany and South America, is that right?
In Puerto Rico is another place that they did some of that study and then went and looked in many places around the world, seeing what kinds of studies they might be able to find where they could look at this. Probably the German study was the one that really triggered things.
And why was that? Was it because the numbers were so much bigger than people had suspected?
Shockingly bigger.
Yeah. Sarah, it's easy to think that fewer bugs isn't such a bad thing. I don't think a lot of people are fans of black flies and mosquitoes, for example. But if you could, explain to us why a decline in the insect population matters.
Well, you have to really think about the role that the roles that insects play in everything that we do. They're food for tons of other species, and they're also at the other end. There are scavengers and our decomposers. They're pollinators. They play all these different roles in the food web, and they play all these different roles in just life in general. So where we think about a black fly as something that bites us, we also have to think about it as food for fish. So if you're a fisherman, maybe you want black flies and mosquitoes and other insects around.
So what does it mean for the ecosystem if we're looking at a 40% decline?
It basically can mean the end of everything. And that sounds dramatic, and it really is. And I think that's why people are starting to really talk about this. When we see the study in Puerto Rico found these dramatic decreases in insects from the 70s, they also found parallel decreases in birds that are feeding on insects and lizards that are feeding on insects and frogs, but not in the birds that are feeding on grains and fruits. We can lose species. We can lose all of these functions, and there aren't other species necessarily to come in and fill those voids.
Well, you mentioned birds, and I know that many organizations have documented the decline in songbirds in North America. If as you look at this work that's being done about insects and you look at what's being done, the work that's being done about birds, are the charts parallel? Is this is this probably what's going on?
They're definitely related, but it's hard to make a causal effect necessarily because there isn't one thing that's creating this insect decline. And a lot of the things that are creating the insect declines are also impacting other species. So it's habitat loss, it's pollution, it's climate change, it's invasives. All of these things are affecting insects. All of those things are also affecting birds and mammals and other species as well. And on top of that, we're losing the insects, which are the basis of a lot of food chains.
And Charlene, if you could you talk about some of the causes of decline, sort of specifically what we know species by species? I mean, we know about butterflies declining. Do we know why you're looking at me like we still have to figure this out, right?
Yeah. A lot of the things we still have to figure out.
Well, you've spent your entire career as an entomologist. When did you start noticing that there seemed to be fewer of certain insects in Maine?
Probably about, I want to say maybe 6-8 years ago. Splats on the windshield. That was one of the big things. It used to be in the summertime, you had to wash your windshield constantly. If you went out driving at night, then you might have to stop and really scrub your windshield in order to get back home. And that's just not happening at that same kind of rate anymore. Moths at the light by your house.
That's right.
Is another thing. The Maine Forest Service runs light traps across the state. And I had one light trap that I had to move because there weren't any insects coming to it. And it's like, what is going on? And so it's becoming really concerning.
So it seems pretty rapid, too, sort of all of a sudden.
Well, it may be that it's been I don't think it's sudden. It's just that it had to get to a certain point before we noticed it. And I think that that's what scientists across the world are saying, too. It's that gradual decline is hard to see. Until it gets to a certain point where it's really dramatic.
Well, I want to ask you sort of a personal question about this insect decline. The other night I was happy to see a bat flying around in my yard, and I know that bats have been in trouble and threatened, and so I was happy to see the bat. But then I thought to myself, what is that bat catching? Is there anything out there right now, or is he or she expending energy that he or she doesn't have to expend after a winter of hibernation trying to find something that isn't there?
Well, there are insects out now. I make maple syrup, and that can be a wonderful way to catch insects is in your maple syrup buckets. And so, yeah, we're finding that there are things out there.
So the bat is catching something I don't see, but he sees it.
Right.
I feel better now.
A lot of the decomposers, the things that feed on organic decaying material, are out now.
Okay. Are certain species hardier than others? You always hear about how cockroaches have been around since prehistoric times. What's hardy and what's fragile?
So your generalist insects are the hardier ones that can adapt to many different environments. The ones that are fragile are specialists that require a particular plant or a particular habitat in order to survive.
Like what? What in Maine is going to survive the apocalypse, and what is? what are you worried about?
So, like gypsy moth, that's going to survive, ants. That's another one. A lot of the different there's many species of ants, but a lot of those can live in lots of different environments.
Sarah, what is Maine Audubon encouraging people to do to sort of either stop this or help be part of the solution?
Well, Maine Audubon, actually working with Charlene and IFNW, we're just getting started looking at this right now. And our Maine Audubon's mission is to conserve Maine's wildlife. And even though people don't think about insects this way, insects are wildlife too. So when we started seeing these papers, we started talking about this as being a big piece of what we do. So we're starting to take a look at what sort of data are out there. A big piece of our work is to work with the public, though. So we're trying to get people involved. And we're actually probably going to do some insect nights in the next few months, sort of a moth night, put out some lights, see what's out there, get people involved, get them understanding what the problem is, see it for themselves. Charlene talks about the splats on the windshield. If you aren't old enough to remember that, I remember that growing up washing my parents' car. And I don't do that anymore, have to do that anymore. It's getting people engaged and seeing it for themselves and seeing it as a problem. And so actually hands-on work is something that we're trying to get people interested in.
Is there anything that people have been doing that maybe they need to stop doing that you believe contributes to this? I mean, are there certain pesticides, for example, certain herbicides that are trouble?
Definitely. There are whole classes of pesticides and herbicides that, especially ones that are very general, ones that are going to kill a lot of different plants, a lot of different kinds of insects, that persist in the landscape for a long time. They're going to be more of a problem. And I think being really aware of the things that we use, I think a lot of people think, well, if it's sold in the hardware store, it can't be that bad. And they'll use it probably more freely than maybe they should. As individual homeowners, also keep having plantings, keep having native plants on your property, maintaining our native species, having as much variety as we can, maybe leaving a little leaf litter. I've seen some pushes for sort of ugly gardens where you leave some of the foliage instead of clearing it all out. Those are places where insects can overwinter. They can have, rest spots. They can be really important structure. And so to leave some of that around and not be quite so pristine about our landscapes, I think.
How about particular species, Charlene? I know that monarch butterflies, for example, like milkweed. What else are things that gardeners can plant to attract different insects?
Anything native.
Anything native.
Anything native. I mean, because the native insects require the native plants. So, you can have some of the beautiful things that flower really nicely in your garden, but make sure you have lots of native plants there for them as well. And don't use pesticides. I mean, if it's just your yard, even your garden, don't use pesticides. And let the weeds grow in your lawn. A grass is just it's a wasteland. And just let the other stuff grow too.
All right. Well, joining us on the line now, Philip Tamanadier, and I'm pronouncing your name incorrectly, I'm sure. Philip, can you say it properly for me?
That wasn't bad. Philip Tamanadier.
Wildlife biologist and supervisor of the Reptile, Amphibian, and Invertebrate Group in Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Thanks for calling in. And Philip, why don't I start by asking you about the survey that the state of Maine has undertaken. What are you trying to figure out?
So, yeah, I'm not exactly sure which survey. We have so many surveys going on, but you might be alluding to a project that Sarah, one of your panel members, and myself and Charlene now have talked about trying to launch, which is to try to get a handle on whether these patterns we're seeing worldwide in insect declines, Puerto Rico, Germany, and in this meta-analysis from Europe and other areas, all pointing at insect declines, to see if any of those patterns and signals might be occurring here in Maine as well. So it's a neat idea. It's one we're still talking about. How we're going to do it and is a big question. It's a very complicated and difficult question, and one that we haven't even gotten down to the details on how to do. But we do. So I think that's the survey you're alluding to.
Yeah.
Of course, we do have a whole bunch of species-specific endangered species surveys that our department does, which are very specific to individual species at risk of extirpation in the state.
And well, let me ask you about that. What species are endangered or threatened in Maine? What species of insects?
Yeah, so there are several, unfortunately, and probably we're only touching the tip of the iceberg, as I'm sure Charlene would agree, in terms of the species that are listed on Maine Endangered and Threatened Species Act, but there's species that are sort of colorful in name and in person if you're lucky enough to run into one of them. Things like the ringed bog haunter, dragonfly, the cobblestone tiger beetle, the Katahdin Arctic butterfly that only occurs on the tablelands of Mount Katahdin and nowhere else in the world, the roaring brook mayfly, just in a handful of streams in western Maine and perhaps a couple in New Hampshire and Vermont, so endemic to this region. And those are, just a handful of the, there's about 15 to 20 insects that are on Maine's endangered species list, which is comprised of 51 species total. So actually quite a large proportion of the state-listed species in Maine are indeed insects.
Is there anything that can be done to help save these insects from extinction?
Yeah, there's a lot. And right now what we're doing and your listeners are doing is a good start, is just increasing our general awareness of this issue. And, it can seem kind of overwhelming. It sounds a little academic to just talk about insects, you know, which are essentially half of all life on Earth. And just the overwhelming diversity of the group almost makes it remote and esoteric, which is part of the problem. And I think we need to get up close and personal with individual species and really take a look at their life histories and understand how fascinating and interesting and important they are. And then once we do that, in my experience, the public generally gets, if you can increase their awareness, you've generally gone a long way towards increasing their concern. And then our hope is that that'll translate into action. And I think there's a lot you can join. The Maine Entomological Society that Charlene's the president of is a great group here in Maine. Nationally, there's a group that's the national equivalent called the Xerce Society, which has all kinds of best management practices and guidance for landowners. And, in addition to the backyard and meadow practices that you can do that Sarah and Charlene have been talking about, think bigger. Think about what's off of your property and how you can support habitat protection at large in Maine. And one of the best ways to do that is to support your local land trusts. Maine has one of the highest per capita land trusts in the country, and they're doing a tremendous job of helping to protect some of the rare and precious places that support insects and other biota.
When we read about other kind of species that may be endangered or people are worried about extinction, there are often projects for breeding them in captivity, things like that. Is that kind of thing done with the insect population?
Not so much. There's over 15,000 species of inland terrestrial freshwater insects in Maine that we, based on latest estimates. So we do very little hands-on, one-on-one, species-by-species manipulations, along the lines of what you might classically think of for endangered species like peregrine falcon hacking or bald eagle nest site protection, those kind of things. But so a more efficient way to work with insects really is to work on habitat protection and sort of do this coarse filter approach at making sure we have good representative examples of all the diversity of habitats in Maine covered, because by doing that, we're almost certainly going to provide habitat for a very large proportion of Maine's insects and other species.
Well, Philip, thank you so much for calling in. And we're going to have you stay on the line for a while longer until you need to go. And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions, please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the New England Eating Disorders Program at Sweetser, offering individualized treatment plans for patients of all ages. Learn more at sweetser.org. By Ocean View at Falmouth, committed to sustainability and dedicated to offering active retirement living with peace of mind for the future. And Diversions Puzzles and Games, committed to offering fun, social, and technology-free ways to connect at Hanford Plaza by Main Mall and in downtown Portsmouth.
5 months after a wildfire swept through Paradise, California, some residents are moving back. But there's a new danger. The fire may have contaminated parts of the town's water supply.
We feel like we are under the microscope of the nation right now, that we are going to be the reason why the town doesn't rebuild is because if there's no water, there's no town.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening here on Maine Public Radio.
The problem of youth homelessness in Maine may reveal itself as teens or families seeking help at shelters. But in rural Maine, the private lives of these students and families are often hidden from view.
I can't imagine how many kids like that we miss who walk silently with their stories and how we don't know what's going on with them.
We'll hear some of those stories in our series, Finding a Way, running this week on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, and at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Insects in the News. Joining me, Sarah Haggerty, conservation biologist with Maine Audubon, Charlene Donahue, president of the Maine Entomological Society and retired Maine Forest Service entomologist, and Philip Demonadier, wildlife biologist with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now, state horticulturalist Gary Fish. Gary, thanks so much for calling in. And I understand you can give us an update on some of these invasive insects that we've been keeping our eye on. You know, the conversation up to this point has been the insects that we don't want to disappear from Maine, but now we're talking about insects we really don't want here. One of them, the emerald ash borer. What is the latest on that?
Well, unfortunately, there are some insects that we don't want around, and they seem to be coming every so often, and emerald ash borer is one that we don't like at all, and we found it this past year in northern Maine in Aroostook County, the very northern tip, in Madawaska, Frenchville, and Grand Isle. And then later in the year, we found it in York County, in Acton, Lebanon, and in Berwick. So we have it at both ends of the state, and it's a very devastating insect because it will kill 99.9% of all the white, brown, and green ash over probably the next 10 or 15 years. So it will be an ending similar to elm with Dutch elm disease and chestnut with the chestnut blight.
And when you say it will kill them, there is nothing we can do?
There is almost nothing that we can do. The Maine Forest Service, which is part of the same department as ours, the Maine Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry, will be releasing stingless wasps that are parasitoids of the emerald ash borer once we start having populations in trees. And that may help for the next generation of ash. But up until this point, where the infestation first started back in 2002 in Detroit, Michigan, it has not been able to do anything to stop it. It's basically come all the way across the United States and Canada and killed millions and millions of trees along the way, and there really is very little that can be done. There are some insecticides that can be injected into trees to preserve a few really important trees, especially if we decide that we want to preserve some trees that will provide seed for the future, and if some towns want to protect certain trees that are really high value. But in terms of the forest, there really is no way to manage the insect other than to try to salvage the trees prior to them being attacked and killed.
Let's talk briefly about some of the other moths that people are watching. The brown tail moth, predominantly affecting areas of Freeport, Harpswell, Woolwich. Gary, what do you expect this year for the brown tail moth?
Well, with the brown tail moth, it's really going to depend upon what kind of spring we have. So if we have another dry, warm spring like we've had the last couple of years, then they don't succumb to a disease that will really slow the population down, and they will still be a serious problem, not only for those areas, but potentially for probably all the way from south of Portland up to Mount Desert Island, and as far inland as Augusta or Bangor, and their populations are spreading and increasing the last 2 years, and it looks like it will be a very bad outbreak this year.
I understand that people are also very concerned about the gypsy moth, talking about expanding the quarantine. Tell me, what does that entail, expanding a quarantine? What does that mean on the ground?
Yeah, I think people don't really understand what a quarantine means. So with emerald ash borer, we are just announcing a new quarantine that started last Wednesday, where you can't move plants or logs or any material outside of the quarantine. So the quarantine is going to be all of York County and the far northern corner of Aroostook County. So, for instance, if you were cutting wood there or trying to sell firewood within that quarantine area, you cannot move it outside of the quarantine area without jumping through hoops in terms of compliance agreements and things like that. So with the gypsy moth, we're proposing right now and taking comments until April 26 on making it a statewide quarantine. And again, what that means is that anyone that wants to move plants, send them to states that are gypsy moth free, or if they want to send anything that has bark, or even moving their whole house from the state of Maine to a state that is gypsy moth free, they will need to basically certify that those materials or all of the belongings are not infested with gypsy moth eggs, because gypsy moth lay their eggs on just about anything. And what the quarantine does is protects the other states that don't have gypsy moth yet from our spreading it to those states.
All right. Well, Gary Fish, thanks so much for calling in and giving us an update on some of the invasive insects that we're worried about here in the state. We'll go next to Nancy, who's calling from Newcastle. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
Hello. I have just finished reading a really important book. It's called Bringing Nature Home, How You Can Sustain Wildlife with Native Plants. And it's by Douglas Tellamy. What he's talking about is that the native bugs are not able to live on exotic plants. They just can't digest them, or they don't taste good or something. And so if we have just bare grassy lawns and plants that are from other countries, we won't have butterflies as much. We won't have birds, because the birds need the caterpillars.
Is this a book, Sarah? Is this a book you're familiar with?
This is, and actually Maine Audubon has been working on, we actually have a whole educational program on bringing nature home, and we actually have a plant sale every spring where we have starts and we grow them into plants that you can buy at our plant sale, and they're all native species that you can then bring home to your neighborhood, so that you are, again, regreening with native species, so that you're encouraging the native insects and other species beyond just the plants.
Nancy, thanks for your call. We'll go to Gary on Facebook. He says, I am not fond of the idea of fire ants making their way into Maine. Any chance of that soon? Philip, since you're still on the line, I'm going to throw that question to you.
And I might pass it like a hot potato over to Charlene.
Charlene's putting her finger up. She says, okay, I'll take it.
Yeah. So the southern fire ants probably will not make it to Maine because it is too cold up here. Unfortunately, there's a European fire ant that we already have in Maine. It's not as devastating as the ones in the south, but if you have them in your yard, the European fire ants, they're pretty unpleasant and very difficult to get rid of.
All right, an email from Diane. Last year in Carabasset Valley, we had very few of the typical biting insects. It seemed too warm and dry in the spring for the black flies, then too wet for the mosquitoes in early summer, finally too hot for the deer flies in the late summer. It doesn't sound like a bad thing, but the number of birds at my feeders was also significantly down. Does your panel have any predictions for this season?
I think it's really hard to say. Insects, even when there aren't all the issues that we're talking about, have they're very sort of flashy populations. So really can depend on the weather of one year, what it's going to be like. And so I think Gary had mentioned that what the spring's going to be like is going to determine how the brown tails are this year. I think that's really true. We have to sort of wait and see what's coming up in the immediate climate.
But I think this is one of the things that we have been noticing is a decline in the biting insects even. Not everybody's going to agree with us, but kind of depends on what your tolerance is for them. But yeah, their populations are down.
An email from Andrea. Rusty patched bumblebee. I'd give more than my eye teeth to help these gorgeous fuzzy little beings. but I feel like Tank Man in Tiananmen Square against a messed up, existing, insane authority, the world. So, Philip, I know that bumblebees are one of your specialties. What can you tell Andrea about rusty-patched bumblebees and what she can do for them?
Yeah, I'm glad she brought them up. They're one of very few federally listed. So there's, in addition to Maine's Endangered Species Act, there's a U.S., obviously, Endangered Species Act. And rusty-patched bumblebee was just recently listed as a federally listed bumblebee, which in its range overlaps with Maine. And we do have historical records here. In fact, a lot of our records indicate that it was fairly widespread and not particularly rare in Maine at one time. But we haven't. It's now historical. We don't have any records, any more recent records than about 10 years ago. And those are just from a couple of places in the Midcoast region, Waldo and Knox County. We don't know a whole lot about it, and everybody's putting their heads together quickly on this species because it appears to have experienced something on the order of 80 to 90% declines across its range in North America, which is why I think it's perhaps the only federally listed bumblebee right now. And we have the honor of hosting a potentially extant or extensionally present population. It is something we're going to look at this year. We're actually right in the midst of putting together a survey protocol for rusty patch bumblebees and to work in cooperation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to do some surveys in the Midcoast region. So that's a long answer on the status of that bee, but in general, whether, you know, the chance of your caller actually having a rusty patch bumblebee is pretty slim, but there are, you know, 17 or 18 other species of bumblebees in Maine, and they could all use your help, and they're very important. They play a really important role in pollination for wild crops and for blueberries and cranberries and tomatoes and squash and pumpkins and apples and things that we care a lot about. So I guess in a soundbite, I would say mow less, mow late, and mow higher, and as my colleague Eric Venturini likes to say, and to what Charlene and Sarah have said, let some of your lawn and gardens and meadows just go a little wild and messy, and you'll immediately see a response, not just in bees, but in bees, butterflies, beetles, true flies, and other pollinating insects.
We'll go to Ed calling from Freeport. Hi, Ed. Go ahead.
Hi. I've been listening to the program and listening to the suggestions that ignorant people like me can actually do something, and I did, and I just wanted to tell you what it was. I had a field that was full of old Christmas trees that were dying and falling down, and I decided to clear them, and once I didn't know what to do, rejected grass, rejected marijuana, and decided on wildflowers. And I planted the field 2 acres with wildflowers, had an amazing, amazing return, had butterflies and bees all summer long, and this year I'm going to get smarter by not picking pretty wildflowers, but indigenous Maine wildflowers with the Maine Seed Project, and I'm going to have milkweed and Joe Pye weed and all of the things that are normal, and I'm going to get more indigenous. So it can happen. I didn't know anything about planting. I've never planted anything that lived, and this was spectacular.
Well, Ed, I'm glad you called because I've heard mixed reports about how scattering wildflower seed works. Is that what you did? Did you just scatter a mix of wildflower seed and it worked?
I bought about 12 pounds of wildflower seed from a commercial company and just sowed it by hand on 2.5 acres of cleared land. And it came up unbelievably. I mean, just spectacularly. I mean, it made me cry. And that was before the butterflies and before the bees appeared. So I had a really amazing, positive experience, and I'd encourage anybody who wants to give it a try to get some indigenous Maine seed and plant it in places where you don't think anything will grow, and things will happen and will come, I think.
Well, Ed, thanks so much for calling in and your enthusiasm.
So some things that you can do for bees and all the other kinds of insects is, eat organic. And think about what you're using, because if If you're not eating organic, then it means those plants have probably been treated with pesticides. So that's a good place to start. Another thing is turn off or shield your lights at night, because that disorients the insects and also bats and other creatures that are out flying at night, and that can be helpful. Talk to your neighbors and your legislators and your town, and try to get everybody to do some of that reducing of pesticides and not expecting things to be perfect.
Ed, thanks for your call. We are going to take another quick break. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Otelco Cloud and Managed Services, helping Maine businesses manage IT systems and business communication. Learn more at otelco.com. By Downeast Institute, fostering innovation and economic opportunities through marine research and education. Downeastinstitute.org. An Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
Coming up on the next Commonwealth Club program, South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg has already been the youngest mayor of a city with at least 100,000 inhabitants, and he was the first openly gay municipal executive in Indiana. Now, the 37-year-old mayor is the first millennial and first openly gay presidential candidate. Does he have what it takes? On the next Commonwealth Club radio program.
Coming up shortly, after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock, here on Maine Public Radio. You're invited to one of the Maine Public News Tell Me More Tour events around the state. As the Maine Public News team travels the state to hear from you, what do you feel are the most important issues in your community? Our first event and community discussion is this Thursday evening starting at 5:30 at the Maine Public Studios in Lewiston. Maine Public News wants to hear from you in the Lewiston, Auburn, and Androscoggin area. What are the most important issues in your community? And how can Maine Public News best serve you and keep you informed? The Thursday evening Lewiston event also will include reporter Robbie Feinberg speaking about his coverage this week of teen homelessness in Maine. For more information, visit mainepublic.org and click on the banner ad. Hope to see you in Lewiston this coming Thursday evening.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are talking about threats to insects. Joining us, Charlene Donahue with the Maine Entomological Society and Sarah Haggerty with Maine Audubon. And we're going to say goodbye to Philip D. Manadier, wildlife biologist and supervisor of the Reptile, Amphibian, and Invertebrate Group at Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Thanks, Philip, for joining us for a little while today. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to John calling from Jefferson. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Okay. Hi. Well, I'm going to channel Rachel Carson here. It seems pretty obvious to me that one of the major issues is the widespread use of pesticides in recent years. And it seems to me that the chemical companies are very short-sighted in producing things that are going to be widely toxic to insects across the board and not have a targeted species. They're interested in profits. They're not interested in insects. So I would encourage people, for one thing, to try to phase out glyphosate, and maybe we could put some pressure on for some of the retailer garden supply places to stop carrying it. It's one of the most toxic things for people as well as for insects. And so I'd like to see that line of thought developed. I don't trust those, all these pesticides any more than Rachel Carson did.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, actually, one of the things that came out of the big paper that came out this year looking at all the different population declines around the world was it wasn't just one thing that's causing the big decline, so we can't just ban DDT like we did in the past. But pesticides and pollution are a huge piece of what they found. So it was habitat loss and land conversion, and then it was pollution, including pesticides, and then invasives, and then climate change. Those were the four biggies. So that was definitely up there in the top.
John, thank you. An email from Dan. Has anyone studied artificial lighting to determine if there are wavelengths that are usable for headlights, streetlights, building lighting, etc., that do not attract insects?
Yeah. There is some studies, and I'm not familiar enough with them to be able to tell you exactly what's going on. But reducing your lighting outside at night is definitely good, and there are certain wavelengths there.
I can't remember exactly the wavelengths, but basically the ones that are like the stadium lights, those are hugely attractive to insects. Right. Also, using directional lighting instead of just general lighting that goes out. Have it really pointed at what you want that lighting for. Turn it off when you don't need it. And just use as little as possible.
And that's helpful for birds as well, correct? If you're going to have a street light, have it shine down but not out.
That's exactly right. And there's a lot of work looking at it can be impacting some of our invertebrates. Even some of our marine species are being affected by all the artificial light. We're just starting to look at the effects of light pollution, but it seems to be harming a huge group of taxa.
Okay, a tweet from David. What effect does the use of high-powered leaf blowers have on native insects?
I'm not sure what it has on insects, but, you know, there's a lot of other things there. It's certainly noise pollution. You have fossil fuel use. So, you know, raking gives you a lot more exercise. And if you can just blow those leaves to the edge of your lawn underneath the bushes and leave them right there to rot in place and give insects a place to hide, that can be hugely helpful.
We'll go to Caleb calling from Camden. Hi, Caleb. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just wondering what property owners can do to mitigate the growth of the brown-tailed moth. I've noticed them in a few of my oak trees, and they're, you know, 50 feet in the air. And I just don't want, you know, I have 8 acres, and I just don't want them to continue to spread. So I've seen them in about 6 trees, and I'm trying to come up with a solution.
And solutions are not easy to come up with at all. This is something that's been a problem in Maine for over 100 years. If you've got them up in the tops of the oak trees, it's really difficult to do anything to get them down because nothing can reach them very well. One of the things that can work if you're in the country is you can actually shoot the nests out of the trees, and that can be kind of fun for people. Some of the arborists can cut them out if there aren't too many. This is an area-wide problem, and it's difficult to control.
So would you suggest first contacting your town and then contacting an arborist?
There's not much the town is going to be able to do. So you can try the arborist. The problem is they're already mostly all booked. If you haven't contacted somebody for this year, you probably won't get them.
Mm. Good luck, Caleb. We're going to go to Jeff, who's calling from Elliott. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm definitely a fan of the mow very infrequently and try and have as much diversity in my yard as possible. And I'm in an area that has a lot of grown-in fields, so there isn't a lot of diversity. It's mostly what's grown there naturally, but I've found that the transition period between lawn and minimal care lawn has brought all sorts of birds and insects that I've never seen before. So that was really reassuring. The other thing is there is a ton of Japanese knotweed off in the corner of a property, which I've tried to expertate, and it's just been impossible. But then in August, the end of August, I find that they are absolute magnets for every kind of bee imaginable. So for the 2-3 weeks that they're flowering, it looks like we have no insect problem in the state of Maine.
You know, Jeff, that's so interesting. Every time we do a program on gardening, I would say our number one question is how to get rid of the Japanese knotweed. But the bees like
it. Grind it up and use it as a homeopathic remedy. I just was in the health food store and somebody asked for it and I almost fell on the floor.
All right. Thanks for your call. We'll move on to Ethan in Saco. Hi, Ethan. Go ahead.
Hey, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. I would like to second the notion that I think it was John who called about the big agribusiness. And I mean, all the local stuff you guys have been talking about is great. But, you know, what's happening with big ag is they're spraying so much everywhere, corn, I mean, all our crops. And I think it's having an effect on on all the insects and bees as well. And just an observation, I have a big field, and I noticed that every June I used to get fireflies, and I haven't seen them for several years now. I mean, it used to just be amazing, but there's very few. And I'm also a landscaper, and I've noticed that, and this is a good thing, I think Portland has kind of outlawed pesticides, but what I've noticed in York County is when you get these new neighborhoods with people put in lawns, and then everyone wants their green lawn, you know, so they put the pesticides on. And then if there's a guy at the end of the, or somewhere in there that doesn't want to use pesticides, all the insects go to his lawn and just destroy it. So it's either, you know, that forces people to use it because they don't want to be the one that gets all the insects. So I think it's better to just phase them out, and so everyone can get a little bit of insect infestation. But like the IPM, Integrated Pest Management, and your caller said, you know, it's good use. You know, you have to use some of it some of the time. But anyway, that's my comment. But big ag, I think, is really, if you guys could talk a little bit more about that and the effects and just the overall business of it. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ethan.
Agriculture, the big ag, is definitely a problem. And one of the things is the products that are being used now often eliminate the need for hedgerows and allow them to just use huge machinery and not have any place where there are the native plants left anymore. So there's no refuge for not only monarch butterflies in the milkweed, but also the parasites and predators, which are the insects that keep everything else under control. So you're kind of destroying the whole ecosystem that all fits together and making the problem worse and requiring more pesticides.
Right. And also along those lines, it's creating this sort of industrial agriculture. It's the use of the pesticides, but also, as Charlene says, it's that loss of structure. So when it was multiple individual family farms, they might be growing different crops. They would have hedgerows between. They would have fallow fields. And now, as Charlene says, you don't need a fallow field anymore. You put down fertilizer. And so you lose all of that refugia that you would have otherwise.
Christopher on Facebook says, I am not surprised that a decline in insect population has been noticed. I drive for a living. And for the last 5 or 6 years, I've had to clean my windshield far less often. Also, far fewer insects gathering around my street lights, highway construction lights, and my house's exterior lights. About the exact same timeline that you've noticed, Charlene. We'll go to Taylor, also calling from Saco. Hi, Taylor. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. I was just wondering if any of the guests had suggestions on dealing with towns that were moderately opposed to any type of native growth or areas that look different in any way, shape, or form. I've done a lot of work permaculturing my whole yard and trying to allow some areas to be a little bit more wild with lots of asters in the fall. It seems like every 6 months my town is trying to tell me to clear cut the whole thing. And I'm just wondering if there's any suggestions or any type of like recourse action that, or some protections for homeowners who want to do stuff like that. I mean, I've got so many bees and birds, like everything flocks to my yard. So I really want to protect it.
Thanks, Taylor.
I think it might be, that being a bit proactive on this, perhaps going to your select board or town council and doing some education as to why you're doing what you're doing and talking about this decline of insects. There is a lot of papers and news articles out there on it now that could help you out.
Thank you, Taylor, and good luck to you. An email from Kathy. I think becoming more aware of and educated about our natural environment is part of the remedy to species decline. It's easy to do a backyard observation. Comb through your flowers, garden, and lawn. Look for adults, larvae, eggs, cocoons. Shine a flashlight on a sheet in your yard at night. Many identification guides are available online. Contact an expert online. There are field trips sponsored by many groups, including the Maine Entomological Society. I don't know if you know Kathy, Charlene, but why don't you tell us about some of the field trips that are available?
Yeah, we usually have a field trip every single month, and we've got a couple of them at Land Trust, one at Bangor Land Trust this summer, and one at Kennebec Land Trust. We're going out to Appledore Island. Will be another one of our field trips. Go up to the Woods and Water Monument. So a lot of different places.
What are you looking for on your field trips?
It's really the individuals can take a look at whatever interests them. There are some people who do collect insects because the only way you can identify some of the really small things is to collect them. But a lot of people just use cameras and some of the online identification aids.
You know, in so many areas of science, citizen science is becoming more important. Is that becoming more important when it talks?
It is, yeah. And anybody of any age and interest can always look at insects and learn something new.
Is there something equivalent to eBird that's going on in the insect world?
There's a couple of things. One is there's a LEP snap where you can take a picture of a moth or a butterfly and post it, and you can get an identification. Bugguide.net is another place where you can post pictures.
And also just iNaturalist, which is open for any taxonomic group, but that's a really great place. I just saw there's an Caterpillars of Eastern North America that I'm excited to get involved with.
Okay, and the first one you said, LEP SNAP, is that LEPSNAP?
Yes.
Okay, great. An email from Stacy. This is related to a question we had earlier. I'm out on the islands in the summer, one of the islands in the summer, and there's a widespread fire ant infestation. Are they native to Maine? Is there any way to eliminate them other than spraying pesticide on gardens and lawns? They have a nasty bite.
They are not native to Maine. They're European, and they are very difficult to get rid of. The University of Maine does have some suggestions on things that you can do, so you can try Googling that, European fire ant in Maine.
Okay. Elizabeth on Facebook says, I would love to cut my lawn less, but am concerned about ticks. We already have them. So a little bit of a balance here. We want to encourage a lot of insects, but we don't want to be encouraging ticks that carry Lyme.
That's right. And it is a balance. And so, I think we talked about mow less, mow higher, but you can continue to mow.
Yeah. When you say mow higher, just set it at the highest.
Yeah.
My husband is a true believer when he mows the lawn.
And, things like dandelions are important. People don't like them, but honeybees are not native, and neither are the dandelions. And dandelions are one of the first food sources for the honeybees in the springtime. So enjoy the beautiful yellow dandelions.
Oh, my. Well, words of wisdom to end our program today. Thank you both for being here. The voice you just heard, Charlene Donahue. She's president of the Maine Entomological Society. And Sarah Haggerty, conservation biologist with Maine Audubon. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Lucy Suchek took your calls. Today's program will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. You can find all sorts of resources at mainecalling.org, including past programs. Tomorrow on the program, we will be talking about volunteerism in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.